Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we have Eric McCoyd, the recent winner of the AIM Series National Championship Shootout out here on Lakes Kakawea, North Dakota. And that is a big topic of conversation, but it is also Eric's first time, so we just get to know him a little bit. A lot of great takeaways in this interview, so let's get to it. We got Eric McCoyd. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. This episode is brought to you by Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations, and to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description. North Dakota is truly home to some world-class fishing opportunities, and as anglers, it is our responsibility to help protect these world-class opportunities by following the aquatic nuisance species protocols here in the state of North Dakota. I'm talking about the Clean, Drain, Dry initiatives. It goes like this. At the end of the day of fishing, or whenever you decide to put your boat or pontoon or whatever you got on the water that day back on the trailer, it is your responsibility to head to the back and pull the plug, make sure the water's draining out of the live well, and walk around, make sure you don't got a bunch of weeds hanging off the trailer. Just clean it all up, take a look at everything, and drain the water out of everything before you hop in the vehicle and drive home. Don't assume that the person in the passenger seat did it for you. It is everybody's responsibility. There's no excuses and no exceptions. If you're unsure what these Clean, Drain, Dry protocols are, I'll put a link in the description of this podcast that'll take you to the North Dakota Game and Fish website, and it'll help give you all that information. Again, as anglers, it is our responsibility to know and understand these things and to execute them. And the reality is that so many, the vast majority of the fisheries here in North Dakota are unaffected still by aquatic nuisance species, which means, anglers, we've been doing a great job of cleaning and draining and drying our boats, and it is working. So let's continue to do a great job here in 2024's open water season. I got to get to know you. I want to hear some more personal stories. We definitely have an agenda here. I want to talk a little bit about some of your recent fishing, obviously, but I would rather just spend a little bit of time right away getting to know you. So what's your story, man? Like, where did fishing start for you? What do I got to know about you and your fishing career going way back to, you know, as far back as you can remember, man? Go ahead.
I kind of grew up into the sport. So I'm actually the third generation pro in my family, following my dad and my grandpa into it. My baptism was actually on a fishing launch on Mille Lacs Lake. Just shot me right into the game of fishing.
Right on.
Yeah. So the grandpa owned a resort on Mille Lacs, and then my dad also did as well. So I grew up working at both resorts, between the fishing launches and guiding for my dad, and also working on the ice. So dad had Maxton Bay on Mille Lacs Lake. So we had 30-some rental fish houses, and then about 180 private fish houses that we took care of as well. So,
and are you live in Wisconsin?
Yep. Yeah, I moved over here 2 years ago.
Okay, so you're a Minnesota boy, moved to Wisconsin.
Yep.
Right on. So Mille Lacs was your home body of water. Do you have a new home body of water, or do you still feel like Mille Lacs is home?
I still feel like Mille Lacs is home. It's Green Bay is growing on me pretty good here now, but.
Yeah, well, because where are you located specifically?
In Kewaunee, so straight east of Green Bay, right on Lake Michigan here.
Okay. All right. On. Had you fished the Great Lakes before you moved over there?
Yep. Yeah, so when I was growing up, I'd always travel to all the events with my dad, or as many as I could anyway. So I'd pre-fish with him all week, and then I'd jump onto the co-angler side once I got old enough, and I did one full season as a co-angler, and then a couple random random events that worked with school and everything else.
Yeah. So, I mean, getting into tournament fishing is no secret for you and your family, but, like, when did you decide maybe you were going to do that for a living? Or when, you know, like was that just so simple for you? Was it just ingrained in you, like, early on? Or did you ever just, like, make that decision for yourself? You think back when you decide, like, well, this is definitely what I'm going to do, too.
It was kind of always it was always in the back of my head to do it. I knew I couldn't do it as my only source of income. I knew I'd have to find some other job that would allow me to have the 5 to 10 weeks off a year, depending how many tournaments I do in a year. But I think Dad and I fished my first tournament. I was probably 8 years old, and we won that one, just a small bass tournament on Mille Lacs. And that kind of really, really got me hooked into it. Kind of, he had the same story growing up too, and he fished the first one with his dad or my grandpa, and they won that one for about $10,000. And
jeepers.
And it sinks the addiction of fishing into you a little bit more.
Oh yeah, dude. I love that. So then what's your status now as far as tournament fishing? Like,
So this will be my 4th year fishing the National Walleye Tour as a pro. And then I'm kind of backing off a little bit this year, trying to save a little money. I've only done a couple of the aims, or I did the championship last week, and then I'll do one on Mille Lacs this weekend, and then one on Green Bay in about a month or so. Well, there's last year we did all the NWTs, the whole Wisconsin aim, plus a couple of MWCs, and then a few local events.
As we get into, you know, like last week, or, you know, just a few days ago, fishing the AIM championship shootout. It was over here in North Dakota. You had to fish the whole series. You got to qualify for that one. But you're talking about, like, this year, you're not going to fish the series. You're just going to fish a couple of opens. Is that the deal?
Yep. Yeah, just doing a couple of the opens and backing off a little bit, just to try to work some more and make some money at it.
Yeah, dude, that's probably some of the best advice you got, huh, from your dad and grandpa. It's like, oh, if you're going to do this, you better have a good job to support it. How would you say that, like, as far as having good mentors and good advice and stuff like that, this early in your career, what would you say has been, like, some of the best advice, some of the, you know, just some of the best big picture mentorship that you've had?
I'd say, yeah, have that, the strong backbone for having a fallback career, I guess, because you get the highs and lows in fishing, and most of the time there's more lows as far as making money and doing well. And then just take every tournament and every day, kind of sit back and enjoy the ride, I guess. Don't take every day for granted, or especially when you're doing well, don't take it for granted. That's what I learned that the first year on tour as a pro. It was kind of all just a big blur and everything was happening so fast. And then after the season, I kind of look back and just learn to take in the days of fishing, whether it's a good day or a bad day, take in the crowds and just the enjoyment of being able to travel the country and fishing all these great destinations.
Maybe, yeah, tell me a little bit about that, like your first couple of seasons and some of that early success that you had.
The first year I fished the pro side, I kind of just set two goals coming into the season. Just knowing it was my first year, there's a lot to learn still. That was to try to stay top 40 in each event and then come in with 5 fish each day. Those are kind of the toughest two goals that pretty much everyone sets for themselves every year. And then, I think the first tournament I ever fished was Chamberlain, South Dakota, and ended up just outside of the check range. And then just kind of had average finishes for the first few events that year. And then we went to Lake Oahe and got my first top 10 out there. And then the next tournament was the championship on Otter Tail that I was fortunate enough to win that one.
Yeah, I mean, and you had to have just been learning all the way, right? I mean, you're still in that point of your career where you're just learning so much. And, you know, and if for every good angler out there, you never stop learning, right? That's always a big part of the story. But I'm curious about all that stuff. That's the tough. Those are the fun stories and details about everybody's career that I think are the most fun to listen to. Like, you know, even though you have all this mentorship. You had all this access to, just like your family, your dad, and traveling to all these tournaments. I'm sure you were listening and hearing things. But what would you say, you know, just on a personal level with the fishing specifically, those first few tournaments or those, you know, like you say, that first check that you cashed, man, what's the story behind it?
The first check was on Lake Oahe in South Dakota. We were making a long run down south of, I don't remember where we launched for that one, making a long run south somewhere. That was kind of the first season I got to play with LiveScope a lot, the original LiveScope that came out. We were just targeting those deep fish all week in practice, and that year is insane for the number of big fish in the system. I think it still is. I haven't been there since, but it was multiple 7 to 12 pounders throughout the week. I remember telling my dad going into that one that I wasn't keeping a fish under 8 pounds for my over, at least until about 1 o'clock. It happened to work out. The first day I caught one big one, and then it was a slow, moving slow from there. I think I put like a 24 incher for my second over later on in the day. And then the very last cast of the day, I had one that was at least 10 pounds that I had to throw back. But
how would you describe your fishing style? Like, are you a troller? Are you a caster? I mean, those things are big, you know, big parts of people's story nowadays, especially with all the technology and everything. Yep. Yeah.
I'm definitely a live scoper. I trolled on Lake Erie in practice for maybe a total of 2 hours, which is crazy to think about because Lake Erie's always been a trolling lake. Basically, if we can keep a rod in the hand and be able to use that carbon live scope, or rather use it to look at individual fish to catch them, or just to use it to look for structure or anything like that, that's definitely the way that I love the fish now.
I mean, you know, talking about, you know, going back to like your rookie season and using that, you know, that first generation of Panoptix, like that was just only a few years ago. Do you feel like, before that, you know, what would your fishing style have been coming into that? I mean, we're kind of in this era now where, you know, the casting is the deal and the forward sonar is the deal. Was that how you utilized that technology right out the gate? I mean, there's definitely a lot of learning curve going on with that stuff.
Yeah, it was definitely a big learning curve. I think I was open to doing pretty much anything to start out, just because dad always taught me just to be versatile. And basically everywhere you go, you can either, like, you troll Lake Erie, or you troll at the river, or you jig at the river. Basically, you got to be good at everything, or most of the techniques. Just have confidence in it. That's the number one thing in tournament fishing, and really all fishing. You get a few things that you just strive to work for to build your confidence, whether you're trolling, or you're trolling guys, or you're trolling boards, or you're trolling lead core or anything else, or you're a casting guy. So you have three baits that you just always have tied on that, you know, you can catch fish with.
And then, you know, staying on long, that NWT championship that you won, remind me now, was that the first year, I probably could have looked this up myself, but that was the first year as it is now in recent years that NWT went to like a true championship.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Where, yeah, because prior to that, the NWT, the championship, everybody got to go to it.
Yep.
Essentially.
Yep. As long as you fished all the events beforehand, you're able to. Yep.
Yeah. Now you actually have to earn it by, what is it? It's top 30 or whatever it is.
Top 40. Yep.
Top 40. Yeah. There you go. And I just remember the excitement around that. I remember that was about the time that I started this podcast, like original. We didn't do nearly as many of them. Everything was way different, but just talking to a few NWT anglers that I had access to back then, I just remember that being such an exciting thing.
Yep.
You know, especially for the guys that do it, you know, that fish the whole circuit. You know, in the spirit of competition, that's just how a lot of people would want the championship to be. And then it opened up. And that, the beauty of that, you know, remind me, tell me if I'm wrong, but the, you know, the beauty of that, where the top 40, you know, it's not a 200 boat field or 150 or 100 boat field, even that opened up the types of bodies of water, that the locations that ultimately could host a championship like that. So then, yeah, the championship that you won was in Minnesota on Otter Tail. I mean, that would have never been the choice of championship if it was going to be like another, you know, 120 boat field.
Yep.
So, you know, yeah, man, like tell me a little bit about that story. I like the details. I like what you remember about that stuff. Like more of the details of that story and how the fishing was and just kind of what that all meant to you.
I managed to qualify. I think I was 11th by that year coming into the championship. So I was just super excited to be that high in the standings against guys I've looked up to my whole life. And then, it was Drake and I fishing that one. Drake Hurd. We travel with him, and then Stacy Forsberg now too. And dad actually didn't, he had a tough year that year. He, I don't know if he was distracted by me fishing with us or fishing the first season or what it was. And so he got fish, and then he had to sit on shore for the game days. Yeah. All week. I think I struggled out there. I only had, I think I was 7 or 8 walleyes for 5 or 6 days of practice. Yeah, it was a long week for me when Dad and Drake were both putting fish in the boat left and right, and that's kind of own body of water. So he had a lot of knowledge in it, and I just had to throw it all out and just go do my own thing. It was going into the first day, no idea where I was going to start. I just kind of went to where I think I caught 122 incher in practice. I think that was the only over I had all week. Didn't really happened there, so I just started looking at the map and kind of figuring out where the deep water would lead up in the shallow humps and the weed lines and everything like that. And I think I put 2 or 3 unders in the boat that were 17, 18 inches, and finally pulled up onto a little, basically just a steep break with weeds on the top of it, and saw a couple big ones sitting there and managed to catch one of them, which was 6-pounder or so. That was about it for the first day and had me sitting in fourth place.
What do you think was so tough about that? Like talking about your pre-fish and they're being a little bit stingy. What, you know, was your pre-fishing style, like, you know, was there something that just kind of made it tough to put walleyes in the boat, or were you more or less, you know, just trying to cover water and see where life was? Like, how would you describe that? Like, what seemed to be sort of the code that you weren't able to crack until game time?
I think a lot of it was just trying to cover so much water in a short amount of time. Honestly, I couldn't tell you why I couldn't catch them in practice. Kind of just one of those, I guess, off weeks, I guess. Looking back, or even talking to Dad about it now or after the fact, the 3 big tournaments he's won, he's had a bad week of practice each time.
Yeah.
And that just kind of, when you go into a tournament after a bad week, you just kind of either throw it out the window or you just fish those couple spots and just start grinding those spots a lot harder. Day 2, we went out on that one, and it was just lights out. We made one drift down a weed edge, and the first 3 fish were all 19 and a quarter to 19 and 3/4 inch unders. We were super excited about that, and I slid out to the deep side of it where the big ones were sitting the day before. And I saw the first one there. It was 11 o'clock, right when the camera guy was pulling up. I just remember telling him to start waving him for a second, and then I threw at this fish for, I don't know, I think it was at least 20 casts. I think that's what I said back then. Finally, after a few casts, you could see it spin. You could see its tail move just a second. She finally just choked that hyper rattle. And yeah, it was fights I've ever had on a walleye in my career so far. And it ended up being a 28 and a quarter that was 9 and a half pounds, which is just unheard of on a Minnesota inland lake. And camera guy jumped in the boat, and I think I just got up front and was doing my little interview for the TV show and stuff. And I swung the live scope around to that weed edge again, right where that one was sitting, and there was three more sitting there, and it was two casts later, I got a 27-incher and put them in the box, and yeah, we had our 23 pounds by 11:10, I think it was.
Yeah, dude, I mean, those are just, I mean, that's just when you almost know it's meant to be. When that second one goes in the box, you just got to know that you're living in a moment.
Yeah, yep, yeah, it was definitely a whole crazy week, or crazy 2 days.
Yeah, and I like what you say there. I mean, I've heard it before. Like, I like what you say about the poor pre-fishing. I mean, you know, there's just something about kind of fishing without the pressure of a good pre-fish. It's almost like a good pre-fish, you know, for some people, it's like, you know, everybody's a little different, right? Like, we're all wired a little different. So you kind of have different emotions and that make you feel a certain kind of way. It's almost like, in some cases, a good pre-fish can put a weight on your shoulders a little bit or give you too much of an expectation. And then when it doesn't go to plan, it's easy to kind of spiral out. I think I can relate to that quite a bit.
Yep.
But, you know, a lot of good anglers just never get too high, never get too low. And it's amazing what you can learn still, even if you're not catching fish or catching the fish you're looking for during a pre-fish, you're still gathering a ton of data. You know, even, you know, some of the most important things you can learn is maybe where not to fish, right? So then on tournament day, you're just more efficient. I mean, there's just a lot of things that go into it, putting it together on the right day. It's more important to have a good tournament day than it is a good pre-fish, that's for sure.
Yep.
Pre-fish champions out there that don't cash a lot of checks.
Yep.
When it comes down to it, and you do not want to be one of those guys.
Yep.
That's for sure. Yeah, for sure, man. No, I love that, dude. And then there was a third day you won it. You know, that was a handful of years ago, right? It was a 3-day deal. Because it's a 10 boat shootout. But it's a three day total. What kind of a lead did you have going into day three?
I think I was leading by 7.5 pounds.
Yeah, big. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so I knew I just needed to go out and catch or get my 5 for sure, and that should lock it up. And I got a little, I don't know, 18.25 or 18.5, something like that, right away. Then probably a half hour into the day, I put a 27 in the box. That was 5 or 6 pounds, and that was kind of when you knew it might actually happen or be. And then we filled out the rest of our unders, and then, so I want to say 10 o'clock or so, I put another 25, 26 inch of the box. And that's the one that it just, you knew it was over at that point.
Yeah. God, that's got to be quite a feeling. I mean, that was your first professional win, right?
Yep.
Oh man. Big win. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. This episode is brought to you by Devil's Lake, North Dakota. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations, and to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com. That link is in the description. North Dakota is truly home to some world-class fishing opportunities, and as anglers, it is our responsibility to help protect these world-class opportunities by following the aquatic nuisance species protocols here in the state of North Dakota. I'm talking about the Clean, Drain, Dry initiatives. It goes like this. At the end of the day of fishing, or whenever you decide to put your boat or pontoon or whatever you got on the water that day back on the trailer, it is your responsibility to head to the back and pull the plug, make sure the water's draining out of the live well, and walk around, make sure you don't got a bunch of weeds hanging off the trailer. Just clean it all up. Take a look at everything and drain the water out of everything before you hop in the vehicle and drive home. Don't assume that the person in the passenger seat did it for you. It is everybody's responsibility. There's no excuses and no exceptions. If you're unsure what these clean, drain, dry protocols are. I'll put a link in the description of this podcast that'll take you to the North Dakota Game and Fish website, and it'll help give you all that information. Again, as anglers, it is our responsibility to know and understand these things and to execute them. And the reality is that so many, the vast majority of the fisheries here in North Dakota are unaffected still by aquatic nuisance species, which means, anglers, we've been doing a great job of cleaning and draining and drying our boats, and it is working. So let's continue to do a great job here in 2024's open water season.
I reached out to you for this because, I'm out here in North Dakota. Lake Sakakawea is my favorite body of water. And it was really cool knowing that, last season's AIM qualifiers from all the different divisions were going to come out here to Sakakawea and fish the national championship shootout. So tell me a little bit about that. Let's get into that story, man. Where does that whole story begin for you?
Basically, I guess it started last spring. One of my good buddies from high school and I decided just to jump into the Wisconsin Division of Series just to try to qualify for the championship or just go have fun and see where it ends up. And we, throughout the season, we struggled. We were like 70 or 80 or 60 or something for points. But the nice part about it is you take the top five team of the year points and the top five in the state championship to move on to the nationals. So we, at that point, we knew that the championship was on Green Bay friends out here. So we made some a long run and just knew we were going to go for fights. And we got our five bites and put four in the boat. And I think we weighed four for 38 pounds or something like that, which was good enough for third place. And then day two got canceled for that one, so we qualified in third, and then our travel partners were fifth, I think. So we knew we had two boats going championship, and at that point we didn't know it was Kakawea yet. And they released that one on just after the first of the year. We were both excited. I've been out there a couple times for the NWTs and stuff with Dad. It's like I've never been there that early, so I wasn't sure exactly what to expect. I kind of assumed it be similar water temps, kind of that mid-50s, maybe low 60s, depending on the year. And then we just started, I have a couple guys I know out there that kind of help point us in the direction. Obviously, the Van Hook Arms always a popular tournament area for good numbers of big fish and everything. We could start practice at 6 a.m. on Monday leading up to the tournament. So I think we put the boat in the water at about 6:01, and I think by 6:15 we had our first little fish in the boat already.
And talking about qualifying, you guys qualified through the championship yep. version of that story, right? Does your dad fish the Ames?
He doesn't.
Right. So I mean, this is you and your high school buddy. I mean, you've got friends, you've got your own little network, but I mean, this is, I guess me as a fan, I'm a fan of tournament fishing. I think I learned so much from it. I enjoy the interviews on this podcast. I learned so much from tournament anglers, even though I'm not one. But observing you and your career, I think when you won that NWT championship, that was probably the first time that I'd seen you, which makes sense. It was, you're brand new in your professional career, but that made a big splash but this AIM deal, this little venture that you have with AIM deal, that's your deal. Yep. I mean, we can talk forever, about the fact that, you were born into a tournament fishing family and you've had, some opportunities that way, right, that are cool and fun to talk about. But, I mean, you deciding to, fish the AIMs with your buddies and be good at it is your deal. And, I just kind of want to point that out. I think that ultimately this is a tremendous feather in your cap. It all is. It all is, certainly. But I don't want to necessarily breeze over that. I think that's certainly a point to make, like as a fan of tournament fishing and seeing you guys that are, you know, guys that are just doing certain things on their own and making their own decisions. You know, you're your own man. I mean, there's no question about it when they see you doing things like this. And so I think that's definitely something that's pretty impressive. And then fishing the Wisconsin division, fishing this national shootout that's a springtime tournament in North Dakota. So you're kind of the away team, if you will. You know, so like that's all a big part of this, you know, like when you think about it, you know, for me, and I'm observing it, I'm anxious to see how, you know, day one goes, because nobody's talking. That's the other part of this too. Maybe you can kind of speak to it, you know, that, you know, once that, you know, talking about you can't pre-fish until Monday at 6 a.m. And after that, I mean, you can't share information. You can't do all that. I mean, tell me a little bit about that. Help me paint the picture there.
Yeah. So as soon as they announced what lake we're on, or what lake the tournament was going to be on, we no longer be on that body of water, whether we're ice fishing or open water or just going for a cruise or something. We could gather information from buddies or people out there or anything like that until 6 a.m. on Monday leading up to it. And then there was no communication whatsoever, except for between guys that are in the tournament. It definitely made it a little more challenging and definitely a lot more tight-lipped. It was a true championship feel, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think those are interesting points, because it's not that way with every tournament. You know, it's not that way with every championship. You know, sharing information, networking, especially when it's, you know, a 40-boat field on a ginormous body of water. Now, you guys had some boundaries, but, you know, there's a lot of water to fish out here. So, you know, when people network, when people share information, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, whether you like it or not or whatever it is, like, man, it's a lot to expect, you know, people to go out and break down such a ginormous piece of real estate, whether you're talking the Great Lakes or you're talking, you know, all these big capital fisheries like Lake Sakakawea. I mean, even with boundaries, you know, you guys were launching out of Newtown, like there's a lot of real estate there for you guys to mess with. So this is a, you know, it's kind of a daunting task if you're reduced to, especially like during the week of pre-fish, you're just reduced to yourself in your own boat, and maybe you got a friend or two, but again, it's like, it's 40 boats. You're only traveling with a few people from your own state, those people are your competitors back in your home state. So not everybody shares information like that. I mean, it's just, you know, yeah, like it's, it very much has that true tournament feel. And then again, that's why I think that there's a lot, I love these stories. I love that we can talk about it, because anything that you guys learned is very interesting for sure. So what would you, how would you describe the pre-fish? You know, what were some of the things you were seeing as far as patterns? What were some of the things you were observing? You know, what were the conditions like? Some of the challenges, you know, maybe some of the first light bulbs going off. I mean, tell me a little bit of how would you describe or detail how pre-fish went?
So the first thing we noticed when we got there or got the boat in the water was just how cold the water. I think the first morning it was like 48, 49 degrees. At the surface level anyway. So we just kind of started on the well-known community stuff. It was flat, calm, and sunny the first 2 days, which is unheard of in North Dakota, which made the fishing it was lights out the first few days. There's numerous 30 to 50, 60 fish days. And then just how I didn't realize how many big fish and how fat those fish are in Sakakawea there. But yeah, that first Monday when we were out there, it got to midday and those water temps were still low 50s. So we both kind of just started talking to each other, like we need to go find the pockets of warm water where these fish will be a little more active and just hopefully they're school up in there. So we just went straight for the shorelines and started looking at just all the different pockets that go in, whether it was the bays or the pockets between the points, just trying to locate a little bit warmer water. I think it was sometime in the afternoon that first day, we pulled into this bay and so we could see him there on live scope eat, and we just both had that feeling like we need to stay here and get one of these to bite so we know what they are. And it took probably an hour, but I think we first time we caught was like a 26. At that point, we just wanted one more just to see what the what was there, what was the potential of that spot. And the next fish was 27 and a half or 27 range somewhere in there. And at that point, we knew that spot should hold up being back in the back of a bay. So we stayed all there. We didn't go back in there until the first day of the practice. So around the next 3 days looking for other spots that were similar or holding that warm water. Wednesday and Thursday was the big wind days, like 20 to 30 or something. So we basically just did what we could. We went to the river and fished all the south bays, just trying to stay out. Got a lot of eaters basically throughout practice. Any spot you'd go to, you'd catch 18 to 22 inches. So you definitely knew those weren't the tournament quality fish that we were looking for. I like to go out till about noon, and then you can come back in and relax and tie your lines and just get a game plan, get rested up a little bit. Back out to kind of our secondary spot that we thought we were going to go to. Took your pull up, made two casts, and caught a 26 and a 27. And just knew, like, all right, we can come here if our bay stuff isn't working.
Was trolling ever a thing? Like, was trolling ever the idea? I mean, this is a big body of water. If you look back in history, don't get me wrong, a lot of checks have been cashed by some great jig fishermen out here in the past. But, I mean, you know, probably not necessarily on, like, a Lake Erie level, but, you know, these big reservoirs out here troll really well. A lot of tournaments have been won trolling historically. Do you feel like forward sonar for you, you've reached a point now where that's where your confidence is? Like, that's how you're going to do the best. That's how you're going to finish the best in tournaments, even on a body of water that's not in your backyard, even on a big body of water that's not that you don't have a ton of experience on, you can't share information. Do you still, you know, I mean, is that where you're at these days?
Definitely. I actually didn't even, I brought my trolling stuff with it in the truck. The first thing I did was take it out of the truck and out of the boat and put it into our Airbnb in the house we were staying at. And I never touched a trolling rod all week. It was, it's definitely where the confidence is at now, is able to jig and then use that Garmin live scope. It's whether you catch a fish in a day or not, I think you learn just as much if you don't catch a fish all day. Whether you learn what those fish are, going by their shape, or just why are these fish not biting today at this time of day.
I mean, how do you stay efficient with it? That's like one of my big questions to everybody is, like, do you spend all day up on that bow mount, or are you still spending a tremendous amount of your day side imaging, you know, high speed graphing, you know, talking about looking for water temperature? Are you spending some time on the steering wheel? Like, what would you say, how do you balance or make those decisions of, like, when you get up on there and you're breaking it down and actually looking for fish versus, you know, utilizing some just other strategy?
I'd say 95% of the time on the bow looking at the live scope. Usually I'll pull up to a spot. That week I was pulling up to a spot, seeing what the water temp was, side scan a little bit just because a lot of it was just sand, so it's easy to see if there's fish there. And then I'd drop the trolling motor in the water and put the Kraken on 10 and then just cruise around until you start seeing fish. And I'm running two live scopes on the bow, so I have one in forward and one in perspective. So using both of those together, you can really tell the shape of the fish, the size of the fish. There's so many carp and paddlefish and white bass and moon eyes and whatever else is swimming out there. Being able to tell the difference, that was the biggest learning curve that first day, because it's kind of different every lake you go to. the same wherever you go, but you kind of just have to relearn it though that day. If you have a week or two off in between a tournament, kind of takes a little bit to, oh yeah, that's a walleye, that's a carp, that's a paddlefish, that's a sturgeon.
Did Sakakawea, did your, during pre-fish, did Sakakawea feel like anything else you'd been on recently? Like, would you compare it to anywhere, or did it really just have its own flavor?
It was mostly its own flavor. It was kind of similar to what I had going on in Red Wing the week before. Just kind of shallow bay stuff, trying to get out of the current the best as possible. It makes it feel more like you're fishing a lake, what I grew up on. I've always struggled on rivers. The reservoirs are kind of, I look at, the reservoirs are different than a river, like the Mississippi anyway, current-wise, but, and just sheer size.
Tell me a little bit about the tournament then. Let's get right to it. Talk to me about, you know, it's a two-day tournament. How did it go? How did day one go? And let's do it. Let's tell the story about day one.
Day one, the main goal was 35 pounds. We knew we needed 35 just to stay in contention.
And on the aim scale, what is that like? What is that inches wise? Like, what was your average going to have to be inches wise?
35 is right in that, about a 26 inch average.
Okay.
So it was, we ran down or around the loop, I guess. So I think it's something like 10 miles in a straight line, but 40 miles by boat. Anyway, pulled up into our spot. It took a little half hour or so just to relocate them, moved with all the wind and weather and everything else that's happened throughout the week. But I think our first fish was a 26 incher, a half hour, 45 minutes into the day. And that just kind of really boosted our confidence back up. Like, all right, they're still here. We can do this. Just got to keep our head down and grind them out. Just kept working back and forth on the bay. It's kind of a smaller base. We told ourselves we're going to make two loops. We're either going to have our 35 pounds or we're going to get out of here and save. So I think we had every fish was like a 26, a 27, and then a couple like low 20s, like a 22, a 24, and a 20. So I think we were at that low 30 pound or right about 30 pounds. So we got all there, all different spots, and never really found much on the lake. At that point, it was getting windy again out of the west, so those mid-lake humps were getting some good waves on it, which usually it's a low as a fish bite, but the wind just makes live scoping tougher. Yeah, so we went back out to where we caught a couple of good ones and wasn't seeing really any signs of life. So we said we can either go run to one other spot that we caught one in, or we can run into that bay again for a half an hour before we need to back to weigh in. We both just, I kind of asked the question knowing what I wanted to do. It's kind of nice being in the aim format, so you can bounce ideas off each other. You know, all the stress on yourself the entire time to make all the decisions. I agreed to run back in that bay just to see. I pulled in there, dropped the trolling motor down, and there's one sitting right there. His first cast is a 24 and a half. So that got us all excited again, and we think we went about 25, 30 yards, and there's a giant sitting there, and I threw at that thing probably 10 times. Backing up a little bit, the water had dirtied up in that bay, so you're calling see a foot probably or so. So you really had to be accurate on your cast. So if you're left or right a foot, they would not eat it. You had to get that bait right on their nose before they'd actually eat it. And finally, I got that, the good, so we're using, keeping it simple, just a jig and a crawler. So I was using a full crawler, and that fish did not want to eat it at all. So finally, I pinched it down to about maybe 2 inches behind the end of the hook. So it was just a little 3-4 inch crawler or so. And her next cast, that thing just went vertical and came right for it, and she just choked it. That was ended up being a 29 incher, which anchored our bag. Which, We were done like a half hour or I guess 20 minutes before we knew we back. So we just kind of sat there and tied up a couple lines quick and started taking an easy ride home just because we knew we had 39.73 or something like that.
Yeah, you almost had like 40 pounds.
Yep. Yeah, so we're comfortable with that bag. So we knew the wind was blowing somewhere on the lake. It's always blowing somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
So we kind of ran hard the first round of the corner to go up river. Then we were able to back off and just take a nice easy ride and not beat ourselves or the boat up. We knew what we had. We knew we would probably be a top five somewhere. We both weren't expecting to be second place, like 1,700ths out of the first place spot. But
yeah, and I would say this, even to kind of backtrack, and you know, talking about day one where, you know, you're in your A spot and you're catching these fish, but going back to like, you know, learning forward sonar and when you're learning a body of water that like river systems or reservoirs where there's lots of junk fish or just the non-target species, like, you know, how much of just knowing which one is a walleye to throw on, like how much of it is just knowing the shape and look of the fish versus just observing maybe the behavior of like just where you're at or where it's sitting in the water column or how many of them are there. Like, how would you sort of describe that here on Sakakawea? Like, how did you eventually sort of start to sift through that and realize which ones were walleyes versus which ones, or how do you stay away from the carp and the white bass and stuff?
So yeah, that was the most important part we figured out all week. It's kind of the same no matter where you go, whether you're Green Bay, Mille Lacs, and any lake you go to. So carp and paddlefish and suckers, or I guess suckers, not so much suckers, but carp and paddlefish for sure, they're always swimming. Whereas walleyes, they sit in one spot or sit there and don't move really. That's the easiest way to tell the difference. Even if it is a walleye, a lot of times, I guess more often than not, you're not going to catch it. So basically, just drive around until you see that sitting still and not moving about halfway up the water column. And more often than not, that'll be your walleye sitting there.
Do you feel like you nailed down a depth range as far as like where you were looking for these fish? I mean, notoriously this time of year on Sakakawea, you know, especially in the bays, guys can have a good bite pitching jigs in 3 foot of water in a spot given the conditions or the scenario, and then you can rig creek chubs in 25 foot of water. So did you kind of feel like you had a sweet spot in terms of a depth range, or were you less worried about how deep it was, just the other elements?
I was less worried about how deep we were in. We were kind of 15. Every once in a while, we'd get out to 20-ish. That's the biggest thing we've learned since LiveScope has come out, is walleyes don't relate to the bottom. Really, they're at least the ones that you target for the most part. Just about half the walleyes we caught were only 2 to 4 feet under the surface.
Really?
Yeah. It's amazing how much we thought we knew about walleyes before LiveScope has come out, and how much we were just completely wrong about just what their behavior is.
Is that, do you find like a lot of walleyes to be doing that, or is that more of a big fish deal?
A lot of times it will be your big fish, but out there we had a lot of 18 to, or I guess 20 to 24 inches that were up high too. And then the difference out there was having the moon eyes in the system.
Yeah. They're all over the place.
Moon eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, moon eye. Yeah. Well, I think they're, I don't know, we just call them skipjacks. But
yeah, skipjacks, yep.
And if you were throwing a jig and a crawler, I bet you caught a few.
Yeah, they're always sitting up high. And it's like, oh, it looks kind of small, but maybe. And as soon as it hit the surface, those things start racing, and you couldn't reel fast enough to get away from those things.
So you get to the landing, you're just a fraction out of first place, but you're top two. And if I remember right, It was pretty tight. I mean, there was a lot of good weights. There was like there the whole top 10 was like, oh, like 34 pounds,
yep.
Something to that effect. So,
yep.
So then going into day two, you're in second place. The weights are tight. What were the conditions? What were some of your considerations? Was it just where was your confidence at as far as your game plan on day two?
So coming into the second day, basically we just knew we needed to go run our program. It's basically just a one-day shootout at that point, since we're all, I think the top four were less than three-quarters of a pound apart or a pound apart or something like that. So the main goal is just go out and catch 40, or at least 39 again. And, Colton was pretty nervous going down, or just, I guess, not nervous, but had the nerves going on, excited to be there and being in that position. We were running down the river, and I looked back at him because he was sitting on the floor in the back, so you could get a little more speed out of it. And I looked back, and he's passed out back there. Like, I don't know how you are sleeping right now, running 68 miles an hour down river, but
hey, man, if I can speak for your partner there, if I was in a situation like that, I bet you he didn't get a whole lot of sleep the night before, man.
Yeah.
I bet you. I mean, golly. I mean, that is it's tough to go to bed after day one with 39, almost 40 pounds, being in second place, fishing for a named championship, which is a boat and a whole bunch of other prizes. I mean, this is legit, dude. This is legit.
Yep.
So I could feel for your partner there, where the after takeoff, I'm sure that adrenaline dump, and then as soon as that wore off on that long run, oh man, he probably needed a little bit of caffeine there to a little picker upper.
Yep, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I had the same feeling going down the river, and if you would have been driving, I probably would have been doing the same thing.
That's cool, though. That's a fun part of the story, man. I like that stuff. But you pull in, but you get up into your stuff, man. So how was it? Like, your first impression, you put the live scope in the water. How did it go?
Yes, we got down there, and we dropped the trolling motor down, and he threw a crawler on for me as I was doing that. So I started looking for the first fish, and he handed me the rod, and it took me, I don't know, 5 seconds to see the first one. Before he could grab a crawler out to throw it on his jig, I was yelling at him to get the net. First 30 seconds of the 27 inch right off the bat, and it was just game on from there. In the first hour, we had, I think it was 37 pounds on the card already.
Jeepers.
It was an unbelievable morning.
So that's a heater, man. I mean, tell me about it. Like, were these fish like in some kind of a way schooled up? Were they pocketed up? I mean, how far apart were they? I mean, and you know, what was the scenario like?
Yeah, so on the way down, I was thinking the day before we started on the opposite side and it was cloudy. So with the sun being out on day two, it was like, well, I need to go fish the west side where that sun's going to come up, heat the water up faster, and maybe get those fish a little more aggressive this morning. Yeah, pulled in there, caught that one, and there were kind of just single marks scattered through it. They weren't in schools by any means. There's plenty of bait in there, so they were staying full, and that's probably why they're still in there. So we got that 25, went 5 minutes maybe, put a 22 on the card, and then it was like back to back cast with a 27 and 3/4 and a 27 or 24 and a quarter. And then it kind of slowed down for a little bit, or probably had to go 100 yards, 150 yards. And then we got another 26 and 3/4.
I mean, you're putting together a bag. Like,
yeah.
I mean, this was your intention. This isn't like probably wasn't a giant surprise, but it still feels good. It's still, you know, that emotional side of things where when things go to plan, you know, early, I can only imagine that was, you know, that allowed you to exhale a little bit. But you had a long day of fishing. I mean, when you start putting that weight in the boat, I mean, what is your day like? How does your day shape up then in that scenario? I mean, do you just spend a long grindy day just looking for 30 inches because that's the only way you can upgrade? Like how does that go for you when you get, you know, close to 40 pounds, you know, in the first quarter of the game, so to speak?
It definitely took all the pressure off. Like, we were laughing like just little kids up there. Just super excited and knowing, hey, we got a chance and we have all day to go catch a 29-30 incher. I think right in the afternoon we put another 27 on the card. So at that point we had all of our weight, probably about 12:30. 2 26 3/4, 2 27s and a 27 3/4. Kept the motor on high, just looking for those giant marks, just trying to find that 30 incher that was out there. We could never find it. There's a lot more boat traffic that second day. I don't know if that was part of it. Just kind of had those big ones down lower, or just because they were feeding in the morning, they were done feeding for the day, or however it worked out.
Was there a lot of boats in your area?
There was the second day. We're the only tournament boat, but there's probably 8 to 10 just local guys out fun fishing, or I think there's a big tournament next week out there, free fishing for that. Or
sure.
But they were all kind of saw that we were in the tournament, so they kept their distance and we're all nice about it, super professional about it. So
right on. And what is it, I mean, when you're on a body of water like Sakakawea, where, and this is probably true in the Great Lakes and all, like everywhere a guy goes, I find it interesting since forward sonar came into play just how often sort of like the resurgence of like a jig and a crawler. But you're on a body of water where the main forage, you know, is smelt, and the shoreline forage of like perch and young of the year fish is really abundant. How do you sort of articulate why a jig and a crawler gives you confidence catching big fish when that just doesn't seem like it matches the hatch very well?
I think the biggest thing out there, I think, is just because the water had cooled down, so those fish just weren't super aggressive. So that the jig and a crawler, you could downsize to an eighth and just be able to hover it right on top of those fish. So even if they weren't hungry, you made them bite. But I don't know if there's from the water color or the water temperature or just being so fat and so full, for some reason they did not want to chase any. Like, we tried the hyper rattles, we tried swim baits, a few other baits we tried too, but the more aggressive style, I guess more, what I say, more fun fishing style. Then they didn't want to chase it and eat it, especially on tournament days.
Kind of wrapping up day two, you guys won it, and you had your day two weight, which ended up being what, right around 40?
Yeah, 40.7 something.
Yeah, 40 pounds. So back to back, you had a 40 pound average for 2 days, and you won it. And it was a very close race. Man, there was some big weights on day two. I found that to be very interesting as well. And it's conditions oriented too, I think. But so often on these reservoir type of competitions, where you look at a big boat field, it's tough to put 2 days together very well. So often there's flip flopping where the guys that do good day one, it's hard to replicate that again day two, and vice versa. When you have a tough day one, you know, it kind of goes back to that conversation about a poor pre-fish. But if you have a bad day one on a 2 day tournament, it's like people fish harder and more free day two, and then they get that big bag and then they move up. But it's the people that can be consistently good. But when you're fishing an AIM championship, it's a 40-boat field. It's not just any 40-boat field. Everybody's good. Everybody's tough in their own right. They all earn their way there. And, man, it was so impressive just how consistent, you know, the good weights were. And that everybody had a good day, too. Or, you know, I mean, just, you know, generalizing, you know. But, gosh, you look at the top 10, you know, and and that made it even tougher for some of the guys that really, you know, they were, you know, mid pack. And, you know, I saw a couple of 41, like a 42 pound weight. I mean, you know, that was just so impressive by the field. But for you guys to put together, you know, 39 and change and 40 and change, to take home the boat and everything that went with it, man, that's just really, really impressive. And I enjoy hearing the stories, man. I enjoy the fishing. I love all the technical stuff, man. I really do appreciate it. Definitely inspires me to go out. And even if somebody's, you know, so many people listen, they aren't from anywhere near Sakakawea, but I just think that this is the kind of stuff. These are the kind of stories that live a long time and really inspire people to have theories of and to go out, whether they have forward sonar or not, to go out and just try new stuff and look for fish in different ways and just think more objectively which, you know, for a lot of us, it kind of starts with really out of our comfort zone thinking. But over time, just thinking outside of the box just becomes so much more normal that it's not even outside of the box anymore. And, you know, anything else to add before we kind of wrap this up? I'm just kind of looking at the clock here, and I don't want to eat up your day too much. And if we have so much more to talk about, we'll definitely do it again. Hopefully you're down for that. But that being said, anything else to add before we wrap this up?
Not a whole lot. I think going back to that thinking out of the box thing, that's one thing Colt and I are always good about is almost every morning we get in the boat, we look at each other and say, what stupid thing can we go try today and see if it'll work?
I love it.
And half the time it works and half the time it doesn't. And it's a lot of fun.
Dude, it's so funny you say that, because us mere mortals, you know, that just the weekend warriors, we just think you guys got it all figured out. We just think that every time you go out on the body of water, the big fish just want to jump in the net. I just love, I love that honesty of like, that's just how you got to think. I really believe. I think that's the toughest thing for a lot of people, and it's the most fun thing for anglers like yourself. That it's just how you think. Just how you have fun doing it, and it's literally the scariest thing for a lot of us. It's like, gosh, am I really gonna waste this half a day of fishing that I worked so hard all week to give myself on doing that? But man, that is it. That's the juice. That's the fun stuff. That's where those really key bites can happen. And it's not always about catching a whole bunch of fish. And sometimes it just comes down to a couple of days of fishing a year for us amateurs where, you know, we do something cool like that, or we figure out something cool like that, and we get a couple of big fish to bite in a way that we've never done before, doing things that, you know, we learn from people like you. You definitely inspire that stuff in a conversation like this and get me all jacked up. But anyways, I'll say this. So let's wrap this up, man. And your sponsors, anything that you want to promote or throw out there, let's just wrap it up that way.
Perfect. Yeah, you can find me on Facebook or Instagram at Eric McCoy Fishing. I usually try to keep that pretty up to date with whether I'm having a fun day fishing or tournament recaps and what I'm expecting at a tournament and stuff like that. I got to thank Acme Tackle. They're my main sponsor for this season, so it's fun having the wrap on the boat again. And
cool, man. All right, dude. Well, I appreciate it. I'll let you go for real this time, and thank you for the time, Eric.
Awesome. Yep. Thanks for having me.
All right, man. We'll talk to you. Bye-bye.